Station 3CR. This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au. Free.
Thanks to the Resident Frequency Radio crew for another great show playing tracks and chatting with Collingwood artists. Welcome to The Living Free, a one-hour show in which we highlight one of the many programs that assist in recovery from drugs, alcohol, gambling and food addictions. Our guests share their story, or their recovery story, and highlight that shared experience saves lives. You're listening to 3CR Community Radio, 855 on the AM dial, 3CR Digital, or even maybe even live streaming on 3cr.org.au. My name's Michael. I'm joined in the studio by my guest today, Chris, and he's going to share his experience of recovery from alcoholism and with the help of Alcoholics Anonymous. But before we do that, I would like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, traditional owners of the land from which 3CR transmits people-powered radio. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present, and acknowledge that this land was stolen and sovereignty was never ceded. Also, please note that the Living Free show may involve discussions of topics such as suicide, mental illness, self-harm and family violence, so please consider your well-being and that of others while listening. Welcome, Chris.
Hey.
Great to have you here, and thanks for joining us in the studio. We'd like to start the show by asking our guests to tell us a little bit about their upbringing or their childhood. So what was it like growing up as Chris?
That's a long question. Yeah, look, I grew up around the Bulleen, Doncaster, Templestowe area with probably middle class, all classes as middle class, although my mum and dad always made us feel like we were poor, and we weren't poor looking back on it now, but they always made us feel like we were poor, and so I always felt a little bit different. I went to Templestowe Primary School, and I always felt I didn't quite fit in. I wasn't in the in crowd, but I wasn't with I had to say loser crowd, but the nerdy crowd. I was sort of caught in no man's land, and I think I carried that in the teenage years. Yeah, I just didn't quite fit in with people. I tried to. I was a good sportsman. I played a lot of sport. Was pretty good at most sports that I tackled. Not academic wise, I struggled. School was a struggle. I didn't find school easy, and was too frightened to ask for help, and carried that into my adulthood too.
Come from a big family? Was there?
I had two brothers, one older. I'm the middle child. I could blame all my problems on middle child syndrome. But yeah, I had an older brother who's probably 14 months older than me, and a younger brother who's 3 years younger than me. Not a big family on my father's side. My father immigrated here when he was 4 years old from Germany, just before the war broke out. So most of his relations, yeah, we didn't know, or either killed in the war. My mum's side, she had two sisters, a twin sister, and who didn't have any kids, and a half sister who had four daughters. So they're half cousins. So they're not a huge family. Yeah.
And so at school, like, did you form a tight group of people, or did you socialise with them outside of school? Or?
Only through sport, yeah. I got accepted by the cool kids because I could play sport.
Yeah.
But other than that, they didn't. Yeah, it was all right when I was on their team, but outside, not really. Yeah, I was sort of a funny kid. Yeah, I found it hard to fit in with people. Yeah, looking back.
And so, were you a rat bag? You know, a rebel? Or did you?
I was. I was a rebel. Yeah, I was one of those kids that if you said don't do it, I would do it and then regret doing it. And that sort of carried on into my adulthood too. So yeah, I was a bit of a naughty child. I just kept doing stuff that I probably shouldn't do.
So, okay, well, so we're here to talk about your the recovery from alcoholism. So when did you start drinking? What happened there?
The earliest memories I had was my dad kept a lot of alcohol around the house, and he had lots of exotic stuff. And I just remember the curiosity about what it tastes like. And so I would unscrew the tops off a lot of them and have a sip out of each one. And you can get pretty drunk. Because he had lots of top shelf stuff there, and I just remember that it just made me feel. It made me feel normal, if there is such a word as normal. I was funny. I did silly things and made all the kids. We lived in a court, and so all the kids were, and no one else was doing it. I was the only one. They weren't game to, because I had a pretty strict upbringing, and I was in the area where you got strapped at school, and if you didn't get strapped at school, you got strapped when you came home. So, yeah, and so...
How old were you when you were testing your dad's alcohol?
Oh, probably around about 12, I reckon, 12 or 13, yeah.
Seems to be the age, doesn't it? This is the age at the time that we discovered that, oh, this stuff's good.
Well, I always felt inadequate. I was a skinny kid. I know this is radio, but I'm 6'2", and the doctors told my mum, buy him a horse, he's going to be a jockey. I would have been the funniest looking jockey, but I was a skinny kid with freckles, and when I had those slugs of the old man's grog, I just felt at ease. There was something about all the kid neighbourhoods, kids were laughing at me, and I just felt like I finally fitted in. So right from the start, I thought, this stuff's pretty good. This stuff's pretty good, yeah.
Yeah, and so but when you're doing it by yourself, so how long did it take you to get a crowd of other people to be able to do that same sort of stuff?
Well, there was a time I remember me mum and dad went away, and I was staying at me grandma's house, and I went and pinched one of me dad's bottles of Black Douglas Scotch.
Oh, nice.
And got a couple of younger kids, and we proceeded to drink that bottle in like half an hour, because that's what you do. That's what normal drinkers do, don't they? And I remember burning, and I was pretty drunk, but the two young kids, they were like vomiting drunk. Yeah. I got in a lot of trouble over that one, because parents of the younger kids weren't very happy that this. And I was probably only, I might have been 15.
Yep.
And they were 12. And so, yeah, the parents of those kids, which I get now. I look at it back.
It's funny. I think that, when I talk to people about the first time they drank, the instance of taking the bigger numbers on the outside of the bottles, like you go, oh, you said Black Douglas, oh, that's 38-40%. Or, my experience was the first thing I drank was a bottle of port, and I go, oh, it was a 19 or 20%. But the West Coast coolers were never going to do it for me.
Yeah, well, I kind of like the burning sensation of it going down and hitting your stomach, and then just this warm glow, and I'll never forget it. Mm. Like, and I always remember people saying, "Oh, don't drink the hard stuff because you'll get into troubles with it." But yeah, so I remembered that, but I like the way it made me feel.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you get there when you're young, you're not sitting there going, "I'm having Black Douglas because it tastes so good."
No,
give me a block of ice with it, I'll be fine.
Yeah, no, not at all. In fact, a lot of it tasted quite foul. Although later on in life I developed quite a taste for it, but it was kind of it made me feel normal, and that's the best way of describing it, whatever normal is. But I just felt like I didn't feel separate from, I felt a part of.
How often, so you've discovered this thing that you said this first experience with the Black Douglas, so how, obviously, you've made a decision that this feels real good, I might do this again.
Yeah, and it was hard to get at that age, although, we're talking 35, not more, 40-odd years ago, 50-odd years ago, and so it was hard to get. So it was a matter of stealing it, basically, yeah. And so, we'd have sleep outs, tents. The old man lived on an acre, so, and the whole court was full of acres, so... All the kids in the neighborhood. So then we'd be, everyone would steal a bottle from their parents, and we'd all sit there and, yeah. And so, yeah, when I could get it, without getting caught, yeah, I wanted to do it as often as I could because it made me feel good. Yeah. So, yeah, and anything that makes me feel good is not, I've got to be careful with.
So what sort of age were you when it started to become a problem?
I reckon my mum died when I was 7 and I was going to work for school holidays and weekends, and the guys I work with are a lot older, so they thought it was funny to buy the young kid alcohol, and I loved it. And so I think it really started to kick off when my mum died and I was 17. Yeah, I just cut loose then, and it was just like I went to work then because I couldn't go to school anymore because Dad couldn't. He had 3 sons, and so I pretty much give up school and went to work and worked with a lot of old guys and off to the pub, and it really started to skyrocket from about 16 to 17. Yeah.
What did that look like?
Well, not good to start off with because you do a lot of vomiting early days because you try and keep up with, and well, I thought I was trying to keep up with these older guys. I didn't realise that hindsight's a great thing. You know, life's lived forwards and understood backwards. I look back and go, yeah, I had this craving for it back then, but I just thought I was trying to keep up with the older guys. And I remember the first I was playing football and they had a presentation night. I was 16 then, that's right, and I went to the presentation night and I drank 12 cans of beer very, very quickly because it just seemed to taste really good. And I remember I woke up in the toilets of this tennis centre that we're in, and there was vomit everywhere, and I'd vomited all over myself. I'd passed out and vomited, which is not very good. You can die from that. But
yeah, there's famous people who've done it.
Yeah, and there was vomit everywhere, and these guys come and wake me up and go, mate, look, what have you done? Are you all right? And I remember catching the tram home back in those days, and I thought, oh, I'm never going to do that again. I just felt so sick, and I got home. My mum was still alive then, and she was pretty sick, and I remember staggering in at home and jumping in the shower, and I've still got vomit all over me, and I fell asleep on the shower floor with the shower going, and my mum came in and she just let look at the stain and she goes, you're going to turn out like your father. You've been drinking. And I go, no, it was something I ate. It was like, yeah. And so I just never forget that. And look, my father wasn't an alcoholic, but he was certainly a heavy drinker, and I didn't want to turn out like him because he was angry one minute and happy the next. And you could never gauge what he was like. When he was angry, he was really angry. And when he was happy, he was really happy. There was no in between. So, and when she died, all bets were off. Yeah.
Yeah, and again, the idea that the dishonesty around my drinking is like starts early. It's not like I've done something. I haven't controlled how much I wanted to take, and now I'm going to need to lie about the fact that I've been drinking. It's like it starts real quick. It goes hand in hand.
Absolutely. Well, to get it, I had to lie and steal. And I used to think no one knows, but I've had conversations with my dad later on in years. He goes, I know you took that. I knew you stole. So I never really, I thought I got away with stuff, but I never really got away with it. And I was lucky because I worked with older guys too that would buy it for me, and you know, now it's, you can't do that, but back in those days it was.
And now I guess if you're working at 17 and you said that all of a sudden you can fund your drinking career, or not career, but your drinking life. And so sort of what sort of time frame is that taking up? Is it a couple of nights a week? Is it looking like a regular thing?
No, well, it was when I started work, it was a regular thing because back in those days you could drink, and so all the guys used to go around the corner to the local pub for lunch, and so I'd go with them, and I laugh with the barman because he was serving me at 16, and then every year you'd have a birthday pot. And after about 3 years, he goes, how old actually are you? And I said, I'm 18. So I was like, but it became a daily process. Once I could start to handle it a bit better and wasn't vomiting, it was like it was a daily thing. And we just went for lunch every day, and then it'd be stubbies in the afternoon, and then, you know, carry on over night time. Yeah.
And so I'm still living with your old man?
Still living with the old man. About 7 and a half, I think I moved out. Because I wanted the freedom. I just didn't want, And Mum had died, and our house was chaos, because she was the stability in the household. And so when she died a painful death. She had cancer for 5 years or whatever, and it was like, It's funny, and I used to, my excuse was, well, she never drank or smoked, so I'm going to cut loose. Yep. That's what happens when you don't drink and smoke. I might as well. But that's just, yeah. That's,
the justification machine was happening. Yeah. Everyone young.
Yeah. And so, yeah, it was a day. I drank daily pretty quickly, and I saw that as normal. I just, yeah, every girlfriend I've had that didn't drink like me, I thought there's something wrong with them, and not realising that there was actually something wrong with me. But it was just part of life. It was just, you know, I was involved with football clubs where it was a big drinking culture, and yeah, I didn't. It's funny, yeah. You look back and you think I didn't think I was doing anything or causing any damage, but I was. I look back now and thinking, no, I left a wave of carnage behind. Yeah.
Cool. We might take a break there, and we'll play some music, and then we'll come back and talk about how bad it got just after this. You're listening to Living Free on 3CR Community Radio, 855 on the AM radio, 3CR Digital, or maybe live streaming on 3cr.org.au. We'd encourage our listeners to become regular donors to 3CR. So by becoming a regular donor, your ongoing support ensures that we can continue to provide a platform for community issues and struggles. You jump online and go to 3cr.org.au to become a regular donor, or call the station during business hours on 9419 8377. Today we're talking with Chris about alcoholism and his recovery through Alcoholics Anonymous. So before the break, you gave us an insight into your introduction to alcohol, a bit of a background about your life. So maybe we'll move forward a bit and see what it was like when alcohol became troublesome. So you know, you said you were, you know, late teens. What happened next? How did it get worse?
Well, it sneaks up on you. It's funny. It's you know, I hung with crowds and I started to, which I swore I'd, from warning from my parents, I'd never touch drugs, and then they became part of it, and then I'll only just smoke marijuana, or I won't do any other, and then other. It was there I was going to take it, because I just didn't like. I look back now and I didn't like reality. I liked being out of it. I just liked the feeling of being out of it. But I could never control how far I would go. And blackouts become a huge part. And I started not remembering driving home. I started not remembering bits and pieces of the night before. And at first it frightened the hell out of me. I'm thinking, oh, how did I get home? Is the car at the front? Which way did I go? And I was horrified by it. But it just became normal. It just, yeah, it's funny when you do the abnormal often enough, it just becomes normal. And I just took that as normal behaviour. You blacked out and it was like, yeah, bugger the consequences.
Yeah, I didn't know that other people didn't have that same thing.
No, it's strange. And you talk about blackouts and people go, what? So, yeah, it was starting to go down. I went downhill very quickly, looking back on it now, because I was drinking with all the guys that have been drinking for years. And I just seemed to get into a lot of trouble. I think goodness I did get into a lot of trouble, because I think it pulled me up quicker than it would have otherwise. Don't get me wrong, I got away with a lot of stuff, but I didn't get away with a lot of stuff either. You know, that vomiting and from the first thing, you know, that happened many, many times. You know, I've had girlfriends find me passed out on the couch with a pile of vomit out of my mouth on the couch. Like, you know, it's just, I escaped death, but I just, yeah, just. And that's not normal drinking, but I don't see that. You know, it just become part of life. It was every day. I was drinking every day. Back in those days, you couldn't buy alcohol on Sundays. And so, you know, sly grog, you know, make sure you got enough alcohol for the weekend. Lots of barrels. We used to have barrels back in those days to raise money for someone who was either going to jail or going to court who needed money. So it was an everyday thing. It became part of life. That was just life. But I started getting into trouble. I was, you know, doing stupid things and you know, police were involved and just like doing crazy stuff, like smashing cars up, and drink driving was a regular thing. You know, I got picked up for 0.05 at 21. I think I was 21, and I could have been caught 100 times, because I used to laugh. People said, oh, I had to close one eye to be able to see the road, and I thought, I haven't been that bad yet. But there was towards the end of it, I had to close one eye to see the road, and that's not Yeah.
And I've had big nights of hanging my head out the window with one eye open.
Yeah, with one eye open.
Just to be able to see and watching the white line on the road so I don't cross over. I remember driving from La Trobe University back to Brighton. And somehow I did it. Didn't start the car, and then I drove it into the fence at home. So I go, oh, whoops.
Yeah, well, I smash cars up. Just stupid stuff. Look, going around corners too hard in the wet and slid into a tram shelter with people sitting in a tram shelter and all. Just, I'm lucky to be alive, really, some of the escapades that I got out of. But I got glassed one night in a pub because I got very aggressive towards the end of my drink. Well, no, that wasn't even towards the end. And bloke glassed me, cut half the side of my face. You know, in hospital, they're saying, how much has he had to drink? And my girlfriend could say, we don't know. He's been up for 3 days. It's like, and feeling sick and having your dad go, when's enough's enough? And I'm sitting there, like, feeling sick and sorry for myself, thinking, I'm going to cut back. But then 2 weeks later, I'm doing the same thing again. It's like, it was a downhill spiral. I went through relationships after relationships. I feel sorry for the girls now because I blame them, but ultimately I was not a nice person to be around. Yeah, because I just wasn't trustworthy. I wasn't reliable. I was just not very pleasant.
So what brought it to an end? Was it a one thing, something happened, or was it just the sick and tired thing?
I think it was a mixture of a lot of things. I got married and
well, so you met someone who was going to put up with it a bit.
I met someone who was, had a lot more brains than me, and was doing part-time work as a barmaid to support her. She had a young baby, and I met her in the pub, and I think this is a perfect girl for me because she's a barmaid. And I don't know about love at first sight, but she just had that, and I just got talking to her, and I was in another relationship at the time. You know, I'd stumbled into another one because I hated being alone. But then I hated being in a relationship too, so that's a really hard place to be. I got with her and told her I'd never get married or didn't want any more kids, and that all went out the window. We got married, but I was living a single man's life, and my wife put up with it. She says for 4 years, which is probably about right. Yeah, I reckon we're married for 4 years, but. You know, I wasn't coming home, and I'd have to ring a day later and say, I'm sorry for not coming home, because I'd just get drunk and pass out. Not so much like got up to, and don't get me wrong, I did get up to some pretty ordinary stuff because your moral compass goes out the window when you're drinking. But a lot of times it was just innocent, and I'd just pass out and wake up and go, oh no, I haven't come home. And she put up with it and put up with it and put up with it and threatened to leave a lot of times. And the catalyst was, we'd had a young baby. And I remember I knew drinking was becoming a problem. And I'm thinking, this is really starting to stuff my life. I'd be the constant fear of getting the police knocking on the door and the threat of losing everything. We'd bought a house and, I was still working. I was lucky I was in a family business. I was still working. And one thing my dad taught me was you go to work, rain, hail, or shine. And I tell you, I went to work some days operating machinery I shouldn't have been operating. And the catalyst was, me son was 12 months old, and my wife, after another escapade, not coming home. And I remember I wake up in Box Hill somewhere after a party, and I looked around and there's drug paraphernalia everywhere, and there's people I didn't even know. And I'm looking around thinking, I don't even know any of these people. I don't know how I got here. Staggering down the road, hailing a cab down, going, where am I? And thinking I'm going to sneak back in home. And my wife was there and said, I'm done. And she meant business, and she left with the kids. And, my first thought is beauty. Now I can do what I want, but, that's a lonely road. Yeah, I remember, I think the next night I was sitting there having a drink. I didn't drink during the day that day, but I was come home and I was just sitting there drinking, and I just, my life flashed before me. I've just messed my life up, yeah.
Moment of clarity,
yeah. Yeah, they often say, people go out on a big bang. It was my last big bang was one stubby.
Yep.
But I just, I had a moment of clarity. I just thought, it's this stuff. But I tried to stop. I tried to, on my wife's recommendation, she said, why don't you cut down? And I tried. I just could not cut down. I just, yeah, to me it didn't seem, I tried drinking, we only had light beer, Carlton Light, that was it, not like the 10,000 other, and I tried drinking it, but I was just drinking twice as much because I like the effect produced by alcohol. It's like, to me, it's like drinking decaf coffee. What for?
Get that.
And so, yeah, and so she left and I was sitting there lonely and I'd heard about AA. My wife's father had been sober in AA and I'd heard about it. And one of the lockups, I'm cutting a lot of story. I got locked up constantly for being drunk and disorderly, locked up. I got locked up when I got picked up for 0.05 because I was suicidal, because I'm thought, if the cops don't give me a hiding, my old man's going to give me a hiding. And so... You know, I'd heard about AA. The cops had said to me after about the fifth drunk and disorderly in about a month, you ought to look at AA, mate. And I thought, I'm too young. And I had that moment of clarity and I phoned AA. I was just in despair. I didn't know what to do. I tried to stop drinking. I couldn't stop drinking. I couldn't even stop for my wife and kids. And I thought my life's over. And so, yeah, apparently that's a really good place to be.
So what, it's about 1990. So this is
1990, yeah.
Yeah, wow, it's a while ago. Yeah. So you, what was your experience? You rung AA and...
So I rung AA. The guy on the phone was really good. He said, there's a meeting I go to. It's in Reservoir. I lived in Eltham at the time. And I said, oh, that's a bit far to go. And then that's the weirdest thing about it. Like, I had friends ring me in down on the peninsula and said, we've got drugs, alcohol and women. I was down there in a flash. It's like, yeah, can't travel half an hour to go to an AA. But he was lucky. He just said, well, there's another one closer. I'll meet you there. And I just thought, I'll go and have a look. I remember going to work the next day and my head just said, you're too young. It just started coming up with all these excuses. So I forget that I'm living at home by myself now. I haven't got my wife and my son, who I absolutely, you know, adored, are no longer there. And my head, and I just thought, you know what, I've got to do something here. And so I went to that first meeting, not wanting to be there. I couldn't perceive a life without alcohol because I'd been drunk for the last 10 years virtually. And so, yeah, I'm glad I went. I didn't want to be there. Even right up until, you know, when I was parking the car thinking, nah, this is not a good idea. But, you know, something propelled me to go, and the guy met me there, you know, and he was the perfect guy for me because he had the same story as me. And I went to my first meeting and didn't want to be there, didn't want to really stop drinking. Couldn't see a life with it, couldn't see a life without it. And that was the start. That was back in on the 20th of December 1990. Yeah. And I had friends, or so-called friends, saying, no one gives the grog away 5 days before Christmas, but I had to make a stand.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what did you hear? Do you remember anything about the first meeting inside?
Yeah, I do. I remember they were all happy, which...
Disgusting, isn't it?
Which I didn't like, yeah, because I hadn't been happy. I was miserable, you know. I had nothing to... You know, I had everything, but I had nothing.
Mm.
That probably won't make a lot of sense to people. I had all the material things and everything, all the ducks lined up, but internally I was done. And yeah, I just remember looking around the room thinking, oh, it's a cult. It's a cult. But no one really preached. People got up. Everyone was really happy. Everyone shook my hand. I'm thinking they're going to want something in a minute. I had a lot of suspicions about it. I don't know where the preconceived ideas came about. But, yeah, and I just remember a couple of people got up and told their story, and I'm thinking, oh, that's what I experience. Oh, that's... Because there's a perception that I'm the only one that has done stuff and I'm the only one that feels the way I feel, and here I'm getting people standing up saying the same things. Didn't convince me, but I just thought, oh, I'm not alone here.
It's an amazing feeling, isn't it? That feeling where you go, oh, it's not just me.
Yeah.
Because I definitely identify with the idea that I didn't know there was a word that described the way I think and the way I feel and the way I act.
Yeah.
And that I didn't, you know, when I heard them say to me that when I put alcohol in my body, I can't control how much I take. And then when I make a decision that I'm not going to drink, I drink. And I go, oh, my God. And then that feeling of, like, of acceptance, we talked about it last night, that the acceptance, but of this idea that I'm not alone. It was an amazing feeling because I drink to not be alone. That was the whole feeling that I was trying to achieve.
Yeah, and I vaguely remember their faces, but I just remember going, yeah, wow, there's people like me. And I got it because they were talking about, you know, going to the bars to have a few drinks and then go home and not being able to get home. And they talked about trying to slow it down and trying to stop, and then their minds convinced them it was a good idea to drink again. And I got that straight away. I'm going, mate, this happens to me. I don't want to be here, but they're talking my language. And it's like, yeah, it didn't convince me. The first meeting, so it was probably the third meeting I went to. So I went Thursday night, Friday, because a woman said to me at the first meeting, she said, come up to me, introduced herself after the meeting, and all these people were giving me their phone numbers. I don't know what for. They were just handing me their phone numbers. I didn't fully understand that. They gave me this yellow envelope. They call it a beginner's pack, which, hang on, let's not get to, I haven't joined yet. Let's not get too excited.
Contract papers. Where are the contract papers?
Yeah, and so, but I met a couple of guys there that were generally happy, and the third meeting I went to, there was a guy there who'd been to the other two meetings, and I remember sitting behind him at this Saturday night meeting that I went to, and he turned around and he smiled at me and he shook my hand. He said, it's really good to see you. And I knew by the look in his eye that he was generally really good to see me, and people weren't generally good to see me. I can tell you, most people, after they had one taste of me, didn't want to see me again, because I was an idiot when I got drunk. I just, out of control. So that's what, those couple of things, but that won me more than anything, that he generally wanted to see me, this guy. And so I thought, maybe there's something in this. And a woman said to me at my first meeting, give it a go for 30 days. If you don't like it, you can always go back out there. And I thought that was a bit harsh, but I thought, you know what? What have I got to lose?
Yeah.
What have I got to lose?
A surrender there in some description, isn't it?
Yeah. And I didn't know it at the time. It was a surrender, but it was. Yeah, I'd sort of surrendered the fact that I'll give it a go and see what happens. And so I tried to go for 30 days. I don't know whether I did. I can't remember now. But I just found while I was going to these meetings, although I wasn't drinking, which was strange for me, because I think the longest I'd ever been off it in those last 10 years was maybe 2 weeks, I reckon I got off it.
Mm.
When I passed the 2-week mark, I thought, maybe there's something in this. Yeah. I couldn't explain it. I don't know what it was. I didn't want to be there most of the time. I thought it was a life sentence, but I just kept going. Yeah, I started to meet some people and
you see the same sort of faces at the meetings. Like you're not getting around everywhere. You're sort of, you know, an area around your house or wherever it is you're choosing to go, and all of a sudden you're hearing the same people or you're seeing the same faces, and you think, oh, they're doing this regularly. Like this isn't just a one-off thing. They've shown up at a meeting, and all of a sudden you and they smile at you and they recognise you again. You know, you're in your second week, and they know you're in your second week. That's, I found that really comforting, the fact that people knew.
Yeah, and when you don't fit in, and the alcohol tricks you into thinking you fit in, and then you take away the alcohol, all of a sudden I find a place that I'm fitting in. It was strange. It was really strange, yeah.
Cool. We're going to come back. We'll have another break, and we'll put some music, and we'll come back and chat about what it looks like now. And you're listening to Living Free on 3CR People Powered Radio. Today we're talking with Chris about alcoholism and his recovery through Alcoholics Anonymous. If you'd like to find out more about Alcoholics Anonymous, then you can call them on 1-300-222-222, or you can go online to aa.org.au. You've gone to AA, you've discovered that's a good place to be, you haven't had a drink for longer the time that you've had, you know, a few weeks. What happened next?
So I just, you know, I was working, and I started getting in contact with my wife, who had moved to country Victoria, and said, you know, can we give it another go? And so she came back with the kids, and I just thought all I got to do is go to a few meetings now, and everything's going to be hunky dory, and life's going to be good. But all went well for a while. We had ups and downs like any new married couple. But the thing was that because I'd been drunk the last 10 years of the relationship, or the last, 5 years of the relationship, I had no communication skills. I didn't know how to be a husband. I didn't know how to be a father. I didn't know anything. I just, they say when you start drinking, the age that you start drinking, you never grow up. And so I've started at 12 or 13. So I was like a 13-year-old in a 26-year-old body. And so I didn't have a clue. But if you had to ask me, I would have told you I had a clue. But I didn't have a clue. And I hung on. I was just lucky. The one thing I did right in Alcoholics Anonymous was I went to lots of meetings. I found a community. Didn't agree with everything they were telling me, but I just liked the people. I liked the people, and I liked the way it made me feel when I left there. But, I think I hung on for about 3 years. At about the three-year mark, my wife had said to me, she sat me down one night because we were in constant fight with one another, and I got no coping skills how to deal with fighting. I can't communicate. I haven't got a clue. And she said to me, I liked you better when you were drinking. And that was a huge punch in the stomach. It was like, because I couldn't argue with her, because I was still angry. I was still doing stuff I shouldn't have been doing. I was still dishonest. I was still, there's a saying in AA that if you come in here a drunken horse thief and you take away the alcohol and don't change, you're just a sober horse thief. And that's what I've become. And I didn't know what to do. And I had to get a knee operation because I was playing sport, and I was put under a general anaesthetic, and I had nothing in my system for 3 years, which was really strange. And all of a sudden I've got, we'll call it drugs or whatever it was in my system, and I flipped out. I wanted to kill myself. And this is 3 years sober, and that's not a good place to be. Mm. I knew I couldn't drink, so there's not too many other options. And I was just lucky, a guy, I'm sure my wife rang this guy, a friend of ours in AA, that come and picked me up and took me to a different kind of AA meeting, if you like. And I went there and ran into a friend of mine in AA who was sober the same amount of time as me, and he was really happy. He was really energetic and enthusiastic and happy and seemed to be loving life. And I said to him, what are you doing? Like, I'm feeling miserable. I want to kill myself. And he just said, we've got a program of action here, Chris, that you need to follow. Not a cure for alcoholism, but it's a medicine that we need to take. And
it doesn't really look like the solution to the problem, because it looks like a drinking problem, and then the problems are all piling up when I don't drink. That's definitely my experience.
Which was strange to me, because I'm thinking I got more problems now than I had when I was drinking. How does that work? And so that was really strange to me.
The solution isn't not drinking. What am I going to do next? And it's nice to have someone there who's telling you that there's something else.
Yeah, and so I spoke with him for a while that night, and then I waited a week. I really struggled asking for help. I just really, really struggled asking for help. And so I waited a week, and then the pain of and my head just screaming at me. And I finally got up enough courage and asked for help. And we went through the program of action that Alcoholics Anonymous suggests. And it's not an easy program. None of it makes any sense to me. None of it, if you read it, I didn't see how that was going to fix me marriage or get me lots of money or help me survive out in the big wide world, because it doesn't say any of that. But, I was surrendered again in AA. I thought I was surrendered when I came in here, but I had what my sponsor now calls a second surrender in Alcoholics Anonymous, because I couldn't do it anymore, and I just couldn't understand. I'm doing what you asked me to do. I'm going to meetings, but Alcoholics Anonymous is a lot more than just going to meetings. So, yeah.
Yeah, and this spiritual solution doesn't look like, as we talk about the spiritual axioms of, but it doesn't look like the answer. It doesn't look like actually I'm going to have a revolutionary change in the way that I think and I act, because that's what I need. The people around me aren't sitting there bitching about my, they're not bitching about my drinking. They're,
no,
they're
no, and you can't pin it on drinking anymore. That's yeah. Right.
You go, oh, how about you not be an arsehole either?
Yeah.
Go, oh, hell, that's, yeah. That's a bit difficult. You're right, that's a bit much.
And look, I had good morals, Michael. I was brought up with good, but I couldn't live up to them. I just could not, yeah, AA calls it lack of power, and I had lack of power in those areas. I just couldn't live up to that. And I wanted to be a good person. There was no doubt in my mind I wanted to be a good person, but I just couldn't do it. And so when I surrendered that and asked for help, and you know, AA is very good at that. You ask for help and they'll give it to you. And this guy helped me fiddle and fumble my way through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, I've probably done a hatchet job of most of the steps, but it set me on a path that, you know, although I've ventured a bit off over the years, I've stuck pretty close to it the last probably 15 years, I reckon. No, probably more. 20 years. Yeah, 20 years. And my life started to improve. And you know, I had a big problem that I was running away from the past, and I'd buried a lot of stuff down that, you know, all the harms I've caused, all the destruction I've caused, all the people that I've, you know, let down, and you can only push that down for so long. It just keeps bubbling to the surface, and Alcoholics Anonymous offers a program where you can deal with that stuff. And I didn't realise at the time, but once I went through the process a couple of times, I was able to deal with that stuff, and it doesn't bother me anymore. Yeah, which is really, there's a freedom in that. Yeah, real freedom in it.
Yeah. So what's it look like now? Like, what does life in Alcoholics Anonymous look like, and then life outside in the real world as well?
Look, life's life. It's like, you know, my that wife came back and stayed, so we've been together 39 years now, married 37. Those kids have grown up. That one-year-old boy is now 36. Daughter's 40. And they've had their struggles, but that's okay. Everyone has struggles. And life today, you know, AA has allowed me to be a really good dad, and a really good grandfather, and a really good son, and a really good husband. All those things that I never knew how to do. And so AA's taught me to do. And if that's all it gives me, that's enough. But, of course, you get a lot of material stuff, because if you don't drink and you don't do crazy stuff, you can actually achieve stuff in life. And so I achieved a lot in life and got a lot of material things. But I'd swap it all for the peace of mind that I have today with living life on life's terms.
Yeah, the relationships we have with others, we can't buy it, no matter how much money we've got.
Absolutely,
I can't sit there and go, I'll just make that relationship with my kids better because I'm going to spend this amount of money, or I've earned this. Actually, that comes through the actions that I take and the way that I show up in the world.
Yeah. And so my life today is, you know, I feel pretty blessed. I have a great life, you know. I semi-retired, I travel, my kids, you know, can come to me with anything. I have great conversations with my kids about stuff that I could never have talked to my parents about. And I think that's, you know, just that in itself is a fantastic thing. And it's a lot to say that life's not full of ups and downs, it is, but I haven't found it. I've never once thought of a drink, and that's strange for me. But, you know, all I do today is AA is still a big part of my life. You know, that was a big question when I found out my father-in-law was AA. I thought, why is he still going after 25 years? I understand that today is that, you know, to keep this, I have to try and help others, and that's for free and for fun, and that's what I do. I get to sponsor guys and try and help them, and the funny thing in helping them, it really helps me, which doesn't add up. That's not street talk where I come from. And so, you know, whenever you help someone, you expect something in return, but I actually help people today and don't expect anything in return, and I love the people that I try and help, and I would love everybody who's got a problem with this to grasp this, but unfortunately that's not the case. You know, that's not the case. AA worked for me. It doesn't work for everybody. I haven't got the answer to that. It doesn't matter. I just know it works for me. But I wouldn't swap my life for anything good and bad. All the bad things that happened to me, and I've had some bad things happen to me, sobriety turned out to be the best things that ever could have happened to me. And without a doubt, without a doubt.
you know, they just look like bad things at the time, don't they? Where our perspective is really narrow because we don't have the big picture to see the outcome later on. To see, you know, actually all of the bad things that have ever happened in my life have led me to be happier than I've ever been in my whole life. And I'm sure something bad will happen again in the next 6 months and I'll be going, no, that's a bad thing. And then I'll look back on it later on and go, oh. But I don't have the sight at the moment to be able to see it.
No, and just to smile again, Michael, and to laugh a belly laugh and have fun sober. You know, I do everything sober now. AA's allowed me to go wherever I want. You know, I can go wherever I want today without the shackles of alcoholism. You know, I have fun. People say, geez, I'd hate to see you on the grog, Chris, because you have so much fun sober now, you know. I sing karaoke, I do whatever I want. There's no, you know, and it's taken a long time because I suffer with fear and I suffer with a lot of things, but doing the program has allowed me to outgrow all of that stuff and to live a really decent life, really decent life. So far from, in fact, you know, we pull out the old videos of what I was like back and then it just seems like a completely different person, yeah.
Thank you. Really enjoyed talking to you today. Thanks. That's all the time we've got for today. And I'd like to thank Chris for coming into the 3CR studios and sharing his story of his Alcoholics Anonymous recovery experience. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Michael.
So I hope you can join us again next week when Living Free will be having another show regarding recovery from addiction. Coming up next, we have Balamoir, The Spirit of War, hosted by Uncle Talgum Choco Edwards, and join Uncle Choco in The Spirit of War on a journey of belonging and movement through sing-alongs and yarns, 3cr.org.au. That's all. I don't need to say that. Thanks for listening. Stay safe. Stay tuned now for more Radical Radio on 3CR. And to take us out, we've got some more music.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au. You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.